Okay, today is August 22nd, 2011. This is the follow-up interview with Heather Daniels. We're here inside Bascom Hall, inside UW-Madison's campus. This interview is being done not only to get Heather's memories of being a current academic staff, and also her memories about the protests on the Capitol earlier this year. So again, we're not going to talk about either of those things right now. We're going to start off with a question I unfortunately usually neglect to ask folks who are on campus at this time, but I want to ask both your personal and then if there's any sort of professional follow-up about it based on your memories of 9/11.
Sure. So I was actually in library school, and I was at a class that when 9/11 took place, and we were in the computer lab, I remember. And somebody, a woman who worked in the main office there, came into class and she said that Washington, D.C. was on fire and there was a huge bomb or something that had gone off. And also that something had happened in New York. And since we were all on computers, we all tried to get on to the New York Times or the Washington Post, and pretty much nobody could get on, so we didn't really know what was going on. And our instructor, Ed Cortez, who's no longer here, was from New York and so was very concerned about his family. And I don't even remember if we ended class early. I think we must have. But I remember going into the common rooms and SLIS, and they had a radio on, and just listening to the coverage and realizing what had actually happened, and that what she had said at the beginning was not exactly the case, but realizing that, you know, that New York, the Trade Center had been hit, and that there was an airplane that had gone into the Pentagon. But understanding in the heat of the moment how that would be so easily to, and who knows what, you know, she was listening to that was reported, but it was a kind of interesting comment on how information can be, you know, misheard, misread, and how that could get passed along.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a huge deal. It sounded like the world was on fire when she came in, and to hear that it was discrete events that we knew what had happened was somewhat actually soothing in a weird kind of way, I would say. So that was the day, that's when it happened. You know, I remember watching the news quite a bit, as I think we all did. And at work, there weren't a huge amount of disruptions. There were certainly, you know, some faculty here and there who had family there. My boss at the time, Ann Kelly, was actually in Paris, and so she was stuck in Paris for a while. And so that was just dealing with that, but that wasn't a big deal. I guess the after effects of that really came in dealing with our international students here. And we certainly have, in neuroscience we had not a huge number, but we probably had a quarter to a third of our students were international. And so for them too, we had a student who went back to visit her family in China, and for a while didn't think she was going to be able to come back because they weren't going to let her out of the country. And I think all grad programs on campus definitely discovered that, you know, I had people who ended up not going back when they probably would have gone back to visit because they were scared they weren't going to come be able to get back onto the country. So it would delay that until after they finished their degrees. So that had a chilling effect, I would say. And I heard stories from other grad program coordinators of, you know, similar ilk, that they had those same kind of issues with their international students. I'm trying to think if there's anything else about 9/11. I would say that was the big thing, for sure.
Okay. Thank you. A couple of questions about a couple of things on your resume before we delve back into academic staff slash protest stuff, and that's I read in your resume that you were a chancellor's, or are a chancellor scholar mentor. What does that mean? How did that all come about?
So the chancellor scholars are, it's programmed through the vice provost's office, and Marcia Lee is the vice provost who's in charge of that. And it gives scholarships, the program itself provides scholarships to high-achieving, either disadvantaged or underrepresented minority undergraduates. And in addition to getting the scholarship, they participate in this program, which means that they meet regularly with Marcia, they meet regularly as a group of students. And kind of, I think, in many ways form a little community themselves. Even though they may have all different majors and be living all over campus, they know that group of, I think it's usually maybe a cohort of 30 or 40 that come in together in a given year pretty well. And so part of that program is that each undergraduate is paired with either a faculty or staff person mentor. And I was delighted when Marcia called and asked me if I wanted to participate. So my first scholar graduated 2 years ago, it will have been already, and is now a law student here, and is starting her second year of law school. And then I was assigned a new person who will be a sophomore, and she is interested in engineering and plays on the golf team. From Michigan. It's an interesting approach, a very hands-on approach to some of the issues that Madison has with diversity. It's a pretty long-standing program on this campus, and also relatively small because of the hands-on style that it takes. It seems to be very successful from just what I see.
So you never have to worry about having more than one student. You get a student that you follow through.
Yeah. And it's great to watch them grow and change from that freshman year where they may not really know what they want to do and they're new to campus and, you know, maybe it's huge compared to where they went for high school, into a mature young adult who has future plans and directions and has figured out what they want to do with themselves.
Did I also see in your resume that you were involved for a while in the People Program?
Yes, and that was actually through my job with neuroscience. So the neuroscience program, from the beginning of People, has been involved in some way. And typically, the science section of the rising freshman People program is a three week. They're here for 3 weeks, and each week in science they do a different unit, basically, or a different area of science. And so, neuroscience has held a place as one of those 3 weeks since its inception. And so I helped run that starting in year two of the People Program until I left neuroscience. And toward the end of my tenure there, we also took on, in the second year of the People Program, they pick an area of science and do a 3 week intense unit in that area. We also included neuroscience as one of those units towards the end of my tenure. So I've had a long affiliation with the People Program.
And was this an example from your first interview of the outreach that you got to do and how you enjoyed doing things like that?
Yes, okay. I would say so.
Okay.
Something extra, we are able to hire graduate students to teach these sections, so it's a great experience for them to be able to work with these students, to teach students at a different level than undergraduates. And, you know, for some of them, it was a life-changing experience. We had a very active undergraduate who, the first couple of years I was in people, I didn't have enough grad students to teach, so I said, fine, you know, if you really want to do this, I'll hire you as an undergraduate, your junior, your senior. And he ended up corresponding with some of these students, you know, 2, 3, 4 years after they left the program. He really bonded with them and ended up becoming, he didn't get a undergraduate degree in teaching, but ended up being a teaching at a private school, K-12 school. So it was a great experience for him.
Thank you. The Chancellor's Award you received in 2007. You want to talk about You want to pat yourself on the back here for however long you want to pat yourself on the back.
Right. So in 2007, I received the Chancellor's Award for service to the university, and I think I'd been on campus since '96, so not that long, 11 years, and. When the chair of the neuroscience program at the time, Todd Yin, who's still the current chair, said he wanted to submit my name, I was very appreciative of that. I didn't think there was any way I was going to win the award. I'd been on campus for not very long compared to a lot of folks. And when they called and told him I'd won, It didn't sink in exactly what that meant.
What sort of things did that entail?
It was great too because he actually put pretty much the whole thing together for me. So I gave him one of the examples of, you know, thank yous I might have gotten from people we had presented to or that kind of thing, and so I provided him with that information, but as far as the letters and everything, he collected all that himself and wrote what I assume is a great letter about me, although I've never actually seen it. And I think it involved talking with students in the program from the past, as well as talking about a lot of the outreach I had done. I was involved and still am involved with the Committee on Women at the University, the Diversity Oversight Committee is what it was called at that time. We talked about the People Program, Graduate Women in Science I was heavily involved in at the time, including helping run. I've helped them put together a couple national meetings here in Madison. So I think it was for my involvement in those things as much as it was about my actual work in the graduate program. I think it was probably equal parts. It was a great, great moment to achieve so early in what I see as a much longer career.
Mm-hmm. Was there some presentation, some sort of award ceremony or something?
Yeah, the Chancellor always gives out those awards, and there's a nice reception, and you're able to invite people who wrote letters for you and your family. And I get to attend those now. As being on ASEC, we're always invited to those, and they're great occasions, and it's wonderful. It not only serves as a purpose to award the great staff that we have here, but also really I think it serves as an educational experience to the Chancellor to see what academic staff are doing on campus and the great things that they're achieving.
What's a nice segue? You mentioned academic staff. We can we had ended with your basically ended with your time academic staff assembly. And we were going to start with getting on the executive committee. So I wonder if you want to talk about how that all came about.
Well, I had actually run a couple other years for ASEC. I was asked to be on the ballot and had participated but hadn't won. And was asked for a third time and hemmed and hawed about it. I wasn't sure if I wanted to do it. I mean, who likes to keep losing elections, right? So I finally said yes and was on the ballot and was finally elected this time. I think that was partially just being on campus, partially probably winning the Excellence Award. I think it was a combination of things, probably. For those elections, it's really name recognition that I think plays a key role. And since we don't campaign, that indicates, that translates into how long you've been on campus and what you've done on campus and how visible either your job is or other things you might have done. So when I started, Susan Crowley was the chair. She worked for University Health Services. And the first year you really just spend trying to figure out exactly what's happening and why it's happening. And to put names to faces of key players around campus and key administrative personnel. And then during the second year, I remember getting a little bit more involved and coming up with ideas for some resolutions, starting to pay attention to what the Faculty Senate was doing, and occasionally mirroring some of their resolutions or at least knowing what was going on with them. And that was the year I also, the second year I was on was also when I found out I was pregnant. For me, that was the first year, I don't know, it's all a blur. And then I ended up being gone for maternity leave for several months, and I came back, and 2 or 3 months later, Susan, you know, was stepping down for her second year, and she called me up and said, you know, I really like some of the initiatives you've been doing. I think you've been really proactive about things, and what would you think about being chair next year? She was concerned that it had been too much of a, well, this is the next person up, so they should have this position kind of system, rather than figuring out who might be the best fit at that point in time. And so I talked with my boss, I talked with my husband a little bit. I had a little baby infant at the time. and agreed to do it, and so start being the chair.
And are you currently?
I'm currently just starting my third year, which is very unusual.
Unusual because it's just usually 2 years and...
Most people do it for 2 years, and that's about... And I can see, having started my third year, why people feel like they tend to get a little burned out in doing it at about that time.
So how many people are on the executive committee?
There are 9 people.
And is it a staggered term?
Yes. Yep, there are 3-year terms, and you can have 2 terms, basically, consecutively.
Do you have to run for that 3-year, that second 3-year
yes,
term?
Yes, I do.
So you must have obviously have done that.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm in my fifth year on ASAC. So I'll have one more year next year.
So I think I asked this when we were talking about academic staff assembly, but I wonder if you could walk me through what a meeting
for ASAC is like. Sure. We typically have the provost come and report to us at the beginning of the meeting on what's happening in the provost chancellor's office, basically. Lately, that's consisted of talking about the various searches that have been going on or starting or ending, as well as any other initiatives that are things that are happening that he thinks we should know about. Just like the assembly, we have time where many of the standing committees who are having an issue or would like some advice or like us to look at something are welcome to come and visit. We often have, I would say, one, sometimes two guests. And we made it a point starting last year, really, to look at who the key personnel in Madison are administratively for academic staff and making sure that we have regular contact with them throughout the year, in addition to any, you know, things that might come up. And we usually have some business time where we're working on various initiatives that ASAC might be working on or some kind of issues that people are talking about to make sure ASAC is up to date on what's happening there. ASAC also appoints people to the shared governance committees, appoints academic staff to shared governance or the searches, which we just talked about. And so we may have some closed session business for that. And then the meeting usually closes with Donna and I giving, Donna Silver, who's the secretary of the academic staff, giving reports on what we've been up to since our last meeting. And then various ASAC members act as liaisons to other entities on campus, be them shared governance entities or some of the important campus committees like the Campus Planning Committee or the University Academic Policies Committee, UAPC. And they'll give updates if there's some kind of relevant topics that have come up that are interesting to academic staff. They'll provide with updates as well. And that's pretty much how the meeting goes. When I first came on as chair, we did it in reverse where those reports came first, and we often didn't have a time to deal with the meat for a meeting, and so switch those around. So if something gets shortchanged, it's those reports.
So the secretary of the academic staff, does he or she answer to ASIC? How is that all, at least from what you know?
Kind of. So the office is located under the provost. So that person's boss is actually the provost. How Donna has been doing this is she'll write an annual report of her performance, and we actually just did this. And she'll share it with ASAC, and then ASAC has attached kind of a cover memo to Paul. Which makes sense because ASIC probably has the best view of what she's been doing or hasn't been doing and how it's been going as compared to the provost. So. I mean, she staffs the ASIC meetings and the assembly meetings, so.
So what sort of learning, or did you have a learning curve by this point once you came on board?
Yes, chair.
as chair, or even came on to ASEC as opposed to being on the assembly?
Yeah, I would say ASEC, just coming on to ASEC, has a pretty steep learning curve. You know, if you haven't been in, if your job isn't in central administration, there are a whole bunch of people to learn about. And names, as I said, that you've probably seen on various memos around campus, but you've never met the person. And just trying to feel your way as to what academic staff governance can do, what it can't do, what are those boundaries, what's maybe too political, what's okay politically, right? Because we're bound by the rules that we can't use government resources to do political activities. That's certainly a gray line when it comes to governance. So I think all those things are really important. For me personally, becoming chair, there are a couple of things. First, I think it was the first day I was officially the chair on July 1st, I got a call from a reporter at the State Journal. And I'm trying to remember exactly what that was about. It was either, I think it was about the unit clarification issue, which was essentially after academic staff were granted the right to collectively bargain, a number of unions decided that they would like to have academic staff positions fall under their union, and there's a process called unit clarification by which there's a hearing and this independent commission decides whether that position belongs with collective bargaining unit A or B. And right around the time I started the chair, this had come up because the unions had started sending letters to people saying that they were going to ask for their position to be moved into their union, which also meant basically the loss of being an active staff member to that person. And wasn't that great. And that would, those letters started probably about a month after I started being chair. At the same time, Donna Silver, the secretary of the academic staff, started as the new secretary. Colleen McCabe had been in the position for many years prior to that. And so Donna and I started together, in essence, trying to figure things out. Together from the beginning. And it was helpful to have us in the same building.
And I did want to talk about unit clarification. And so I guess I wonder, I mean, there's a nice overview there. I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind giving us the progression of unit clarification.
Sure.
Because then I think that also sort of ties into what happened in February and March and, mm-hmm. and actually later on this year too.
Mm-hmm. So these letters, as I said, these letters went out to people's work addresses, so they got them at work. And WEPEC, Wisconsin Science Professionals, I think were the two unions that sent out letters to people. And I started hearing about them. I actually received a letter myself and took it to Steve Lund, the head of academic personnel, and asked him, tell me more about this process. What are they talking about? And he explained basically the overview of how things worked. And people were very concerned about, and they were concerned that their voice wouldn't be heard about what they did, why it was academic staff, which is true. The individual whose position is at the hearing has no standing at that hearing to talk. People were concerned about losing their professional status. Some of the unions that were thinking about unit clarification didn't have any professionals within their union. And it was actually, I think people started to appreciate it, understand what it meant to be academic staff on this campus at that point when it was, right, you don't appreciate something until somebody wants to take it away. People were concerned about losing their governance rights because classified staff in the state statutes don't have any governance rights at UW. So I think there were a whole host of reasons why people were concerned. And the idea that somebody could take that from you with you not having any say, I think really disturbed many, many people. In the end, there were 5, I believe, petitions that were actually filed. And that happened that fall. And they were for employees at other UW system campuses, not for Madison. I think the idea being that, you know, they tried something smaller, and if that works, then go for the big fish. UW system is that they would fight the petitions, you know, legally. They didn't feel that the independent commission, which is the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission, had the authority, statutory authority, to decide who was academic staff. They felt that rested only with the Board of Regents. And OSER, the Office of State Employment Relations, agreed with that because they're the other entity that gets to decide whether somebody's classified or unclassified as well. So they actually, strangely, joined together on a joint lawsuit and filed papers against the petitions. Of course, the commission were the ones who ruled on whether they had authority to hear them or not, which is kind of an odd twist to the story, and ruled in favor of themselves having the authority, which I guess nobody should be surprised about. And so UW system, and I don't remember if OSER's on this lawsuit as well, took the additional step then of filing a lawsuit in Dane County Court, basically saying that WERC does not have the authority to hear these and should not proceed until this dispute is settled, basically. As far as academic staff governance on Madison's campus, we had set up a committee called the Ad Hoc Committee on Collective Bargaining, mainly to become an information source for collective bargaining information, because this, of course, was going on at the same time. But that committee really morphed into a committee that collected information on, you know, clarification. And so they interviewed the major players, they interviewed people from the unions to try to get more information on why they thought this was a good thing. Interestingly, one of the unions that had sent out the original letters, the Wisconsin Science Professionals, upon hearing kind of the backlash of academic staff, decided that they were no longer interested in having academic staff in their union if we weren't interested in joining their union. And so they backed off and didn't end up filing any petitions. So the Ad Hoc Committee on Collective Bargaining played a huge role in collecting information in one central place. Looking at, well, if you became classified staff, what does that mean in terms of your vacation, your sick leave, et cetera, et cetera? What does that mean in terms of your pay? Because the pay structure between academic staff and classified staff is very different. And tried to get some of those fundamentals out there to everyone, which is great. And Russell Diamond chaired that committee and did a wonderful job at that. Academic Staff Assembly held a, or voted and passed a resolution against unit clarification, or this use of unit clarification, I guess I should say, even though petitions had not been filed on the Madison campus. It was obvious what was going to happen should those petitions be approved, so we wanted to make sure our voice was out there early. And just because the number of positions that Madison would have that might have fallen into these petitions was huge.
Now, Heather, time-wise, does this take us, at least in your memory of it, take us to around election time this year, or I should say last year, so the election of 2010, or are we still?
So I would say that first wave of things took about a year. I think the lawsuit got filed by UWA System and Dane County Circuit Court around March of 2010. It seems so long ago. At the same time, ASPRO, the Academic Staff Professional Representation Organization, which is a it's a UW System organization that was organized first by UW Madison to combat attempts by the legislature to divide pay raises differently between faculty and academic staff. Decided to look at maybe some legislative fixes to this issue. And in fact, this past spring it had, and that'd be spring of 2011, there was a bill in both the Senate and the Assembly that were introduced to basically clarify that the Board of Regents and OSER were the only two entities that could decide who were academic staff. And what ended up happening is those type of changes got introduced in the budget bill, and so have now become law with Scott Walker signing the budget bill. So we actually fixed unit clarification in the budget bill, so it can't happen again. But that was it's a 2-year process basically from start to finish, which I suppose in political terms is probably pretty fast. We also had the Madison Academic Staff Association held kind of after the petitions had been filed, so kind of that winter ended up holding a brown bag to just give everyone an update on where we were with the unit clarification issue. And I remember the room, we must have had 130 people in that room for a meantime brown bag. And Russell Diamond was at it, I was at it, and then we invited the lawyer from UW System who was handling the case to talk a little bit about the legal perspective of what was happening. So it was clearly an issue that was of great interest and importance to academic staff, and honestly made people maybe appreciate academic staff governance and what being academic staff meant more than they had previously. We hadn't had a lot of big controversial issues probably in the past decade or so, since probably the previous attempt to change merit between faculty and academic staff. So it was a good awakening, I think. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to spend the rest of our time today talking about the buildup and then the protests and then the aftermath. So I guess I'll start this way. So when the election happens in 2010, we have a Republican legislature, Republican governor, one of our Senate, U.S. Senate seats is Republican. It's, at that point, so November and then early in 2011, do you or you through your academic staff, ASIC hat, chair hat, have any inkling of what may happen and how it may affect this campus?
No. I would say anyone we talk to, you know, and that would be folks here on campus or the ASPRA lobbyists, I think everyone thought there would be some kind of changes because collective bargaining had expanded quite a bit under the Doyle administration, especially when Doyle was the governor and the Dems were in charge of the legislature. But no one I heard predicted an all-out assault on pretty much any kind of collective bargaining. I think people thought changes would happen. You know, I heard probably faculty and staff would lose their right to collectively bargain. You know, it sounded like perhaps some of the issues that they had recently won the right to collective bargain around, some of the work issues, might be scaled back. But I don't think anybody thought that it would be basically a that collective bargaining will basically go away.
And it's also around this time, not necessarily before the legislature's in session, but really before the February announcement, the February 11th announcement, that I think we start to get wind of this new Badger partnership.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, it seems so long ago, but it was only, you know, 6-8 months ago.
Right.
Again, either you as an academic staff or you with ASIC chair, what you remember hearing about the new Badger partnership and what your thoughts were.
So we heard a little bit about it that fall semester. I know ASEC had Vince Sweeney in to talk about it. He brought a PowerPoint. And it was so vague at the time, it was hard to form an opinion about it. I mean, there were a lot of things in it that I think we'd wanted for a long, long time. But it wasn't clear, even then it was, you know, it was flexibilities around personnel. I don't even really know what that means. And so it was hard to form an opinion about something where you didn't have enough specifics. Sure, we'd like flexibility around personnel, but maybe there's some flexibilities we don't want. I don't know. There's certainly, I think you could say that about a lot of areas. And so we knew about it. We knew that that the chancellor had met with the candidates for governor when they were candidates and kind of talked about a new relationship that the state might have with the university and explained to them some of the difficulties we suffer as being treated like the DNR or any other state agency. I don't know why the DNR is always picked up. It's someone that comes to people's minds.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume she had continued to talk with the Governor Walker once he was elected about those things. But we didn't have a lot of details. And then it was, I think, in January when the Journal Sentinel broke the news that what Walker was planning to ask for was a public authority. And it included a leaked email between the governor's office and the chancellor.
At that time, and I'm not even sure I really know what exactly that means today, even through all of this, but at that time, again, it's, I know you have sort of two hats you're wearing here, but they're not necessarily different. What did that mean to you?
Well, I knew the hospital was a public authority. And I knew from working at the medical school that they had flexibilities about rewarding their employees that we didn't have. The medical school actually started a employee recognition day to kind of level the playing field, if you will, because they often have medical school personnel working next to hospital staff. Hospital always does an employee recognition day, and they get stuff, and they have, you know, get free food, and we had done nothing. So they started kind of a little ice cream social with little gifts that they started to give away to employees. But that was really the extent of my knowledge about what a public authority meant.
So it probably wasn't soon after the leaked Journal Sentinel article that Governor Walker sends out an email that I think is about the budget repair bill, and and part of the aspect of the budget repair bill is that collective bargaining will be eliminated.
Probably, all intents and purposes,
right,
yes.
Right. It wasn't said exactly that way, but it was easy to intuit from that.
Yes.
And the protests started here on campus, well, I mean, in the Capitol, but from here on campus, on Valentine's Day with the TAs, and then after that, more and more people. So I'm wondering if you could walk me through again, either you as a staff person or you as a member of the state, what you thought as the protests started and then as they built up momentum.
Sure. I think the budget repair bill came out maybe the Thursday before our February assembly meeting. And so we were able to draft a resolution opposing it and pass it at that assembly meeting in February. And it was just happenstance that the timing worked out in that way, which was great. Personally, I remember hearing that the hearings were taking place about the bill with the Joint Finance Committee. And I felt, because of unit clarification, that I had an interesting story to tell. I mean, academic staff, I would say, are probably not in love with unions on this campus because of the unit clarification. But that didn't mean we didn't do joint things with them. That didn't mean we didn't talk to them. That there are other ways that grown-ups deal with problems. And I thought that was maybe something they wouldn't hear. So I remember it was seriously like 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and I'm watching Wisconsin Eye, and they're testifying, and I said to my husband, I'm like, I feel like I have to go down there and try to testify, because what I want to say, I'm not hearing anyone say. I think it's an interesting perspective. I think it might, maybe the Republicans might hear this, as somebody who's not a rah-rah union supporter all the way, no matter what. And so I went down to the Capitol, and I didn't know what I was going to say, but I figured I'd have plenty of time to write something. And I arrived at the moment where there was kind of chaos going on because they had shut everyone out of the meeting. They weren't sure if they were going to continue. They were debating internally in the Joint Finance Committee. Nobody seemed to know what was really going on. We were lined up down the hallway, down the stairs. At one point, people started chanting, "Let us in." And so I got there at a moment of great confusion. So I wrote my statement while I sat there. I believe they called off the meeting around 2 o'clock and decided not to continue listening to people. And the Democrats gave a press conference soon after that, and I stuck around for that. My Senator Mark Miller was there, of course, as the Democratic minority leader. And so I gave him my statement and said I wasn't able to testify, but you're my senator, here you go. Not the audience I wanted to deliver my statement to. And so I went home. Didn't get a lot of sleep and got up the next morning and went to work. But it was an exhilarating, definitely adrenaline pumping experience being there. And I told my husband when I decided I wanted to go down, I said, you know, I think if I don't go, I'm going to regret it. Even though I have a 2-year-old. I don't stay up past, you know, 11 o'clock most nights.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty incredible. Just the energy of people, the enthusiasm, that kind of youthful expectation that what you're going to do is going to make a difference. And I pretty much went up to the Capitol as much as I could after work, between going to work and going home. The Democrats started holding their own all-night session hearings about the bill, I think in part to keep the Capitol open. And I ended up going down on my birthday because I still hadn't testified and I felt like I wanted to say the words. And I think I got there again around 10 or so and finally testified at around 2 o'clock a.m. And that felt, even again, it wasn't the audience the message was intended for, and so it was probably received in quite a different manner than I had hoped. It was fulfilling to have completed that task.
So how do you feel this all played out in the protests and then the passage of the budget repair bill and the eventual passage of the budget bill? How do you, and then the new Badger partnership not actually becoming officially the new Badger partnership, but there's aspects of it that made it through. How do you feel that will or has already affected academic staff?
I think academic staff morale on this campus right now is probably, at least while I've been here, an all-time low. And I don't know if in the past there was a lower time. I think while many of us feel we can absorb the kind of cuts that we're being asked to make, their personal incomes, we know there are many that can't without a huge amount of sacrifice. That plus knowing that our salaries on this campus in general are relatively low compared to our peers has made it relatively easy, just like faculty, to pick off really good academic staff. And people who are bringing in grants as PIs, if they can make a lot more elsewhere, why would you stay here? I wouldn't. I think the one thing that leveled the playing field for this university were the good benefits that we had. And if those are gone, we're definitely at the bottom of that teeter-totter again. We aren't equal anymore to our peers. I think that coupled with frustration of how there seems to be a lack of attention paid to how work is distributed on campus. I think this is an ongoing challenge and affects classified staff and academic staff equally. What I saw at the med school, I was there, and I was there about a dozen years, was department staff shrinking, administrative staff centrally growing, but yet more tasks being delegated to departments. And at some point, that's a losing model because your departments are going to be overwhelmed, as I think they are right now with HRS. And yet you've got this kind of administrative load centrally, because if you're the dean and you can decide where the cuts are going to be, you're not going to cut your staff centrally. Why would you do that? You're going to cut it at the department level. And I think that's, from what I can tell, pretty much probably true across the campus. I don't know how well central administration has made sure those cuts are even. And so I know a lot of staff, both academic staff and classified, feel very overburdened by their workload. I'm a perfect example of that, right? In neuroscience, I probably worked 50 to 60 hours a week, every week. And there were weeks that I worked probably 80 hours when we were doing recruiting. I was married, no kids. That's fine, I can do that there. Although one may say, clearly, you need more help. No doubt the people who are there now, there's an additional half-time person that does my job. And I came up here and now I have a reasonable workload, I would say. But I also have a baby and that happened at about the same time, so it was great for me. But I'm in central administration for the grad school, and so I think there's more of a understanding of what the workload is there, perhaps. And perhaps I shouldn't be so harsh on deans. Maybe it's not necessarily that they're doing it deliberately. Maybe they don't understand how departments have been given more and more work to do with less staff. It's very possible departments haven't made that clear either. I think those two things have been huge, the money issue and the workload issue for academic staff. On the very positive side, and it's funny because I just recently sent out kind of a, now that the budget bill has been signed, this is what it means to academic staff in all areas, kind of message to everyone. And I said, there are positives and negatives, and I got this email back from this guy who said, well, I know my paycheck is going to be cut, but what's the positive? So the positive side is by far the personnel system and the ability for Madison to have its own personnel system. There are a lot of artificial barriers that have been created, both I think initially as part of the current system we're in and also through the years, that make it virtually impossible for an academic staff member who's in Category A, which is basically everyone except your researcher scientists or your instruction lecturer folks, for them to have a relatively long career in the same place without hitting some sort of ceiling on their compensation. We also have rules like if Department B wants to recruit your scientist, you can't make a counter offer, which is silly. I understand we don't want to play the game where, you know, Department B just says they want them so that A, you know, that scientist can get a raise, but clearly we need to have ways that we can address compensation in reasonable ways that I hate to bring the business model in, but no business would function with this personnel system. So the ability to create that, fix, and hopefully not create new problems, I think is, you know, the one hope that, if anything's hopeful, that's what it is for academic staff.
Okay. So again, we're at an hour. You know, there is one thing I want to ask, and this is all out of the chronology, but I forgot to ask it earlier, is that you did change jobs a few years ago.
Yes.
And I think it's important, you know, since an oral history of your time here on campus, to talk about basically, you know, why you changed jobs, and then if you could give an overview of what your current job is.
Sure, sure. So, I'd say that was precipitated by a couple things. First of all, I think it's always good to look for new jobs, and I'm always looking at the PBLs to see what's out there. I think interviewing for jobs is always great practice, even if it ends up it's not a job you're interested in or it's not a job you get an offer on. Ann Kelly, who was chair of the program after Ron Khalil, and I know I talked a little bit about her last time and about Ron, developed cancer and ended up dying in 2007, summer of 2007. And that experience was difficult. She was 52 years old. She left kids in K-12. She had three kids, two which were still in middle and high school, and one who had graduated from college. And she had been a mentor to a lot of neuroscience students. Obviously, she was the chair. And she actually found out she had cancer when she was on sabbatical. So her dying, I think, left a kind of a gap for me in neuroscience, a whole. And by that time, Tom Yin had already become chair. He'd been chair for a year. But I think that, in part, got me kind of interested in looking to see what else was out there, because I realized life isn't forever, so it's good to explore your options. I also served on that time as a member of a committee that was looking at tuition for training grants, which are a specialized type of grants that NIH gives for supporting pre-docs, and they don't provide the full cost of tuition. and this campus has struggled for a long time as to what to do about that. And so I've been working with somebody in the grad school who was also on the committee about various things in relation to that committee. And he mentioned to me that they were having this opening and would be partially doing research administration, partially working with training grants and some other stuff, and they'd love to see an application from me. And I thought about it for a while and decided to put in the application and was interviewed and got the job. I stayed on for probably 2.5 months, I think, maybe even 3 months after I got the position at Neuroscience, because we were in the middle of admissions and I didn't want to leave the program kind of in the middle of that with no administrator, especially knowing how much I did for that process. And it was hard leaving Neuroscience. I adored the people there. I love working with students and still keep in touch with many of them in my new job, which is fun to talk with them. At the same time, I found out I was pregnant. Realized I could never do neuroscience justice with a baby. I just wouldn't have the time or energy, probably. And really, you know, looking back on it, things all kind of fell into place at the right time there, just coincidentally.
I want to make sure again that you have the last word here before we shut it down for the day. Is there anything on your mind that you want to get off of it before we conclude? Anything? I'm sure there's obviously always something on our mind.
Sure.
It's whether it's something you feel appropriate to get down for the record. Well, I always reserve the right to sort of look through these, and if I think there's sort of enough questions to merit another interview, I'll give you an email and see if we can set something up. But if that doesn't happen, I want to thank you for giving us your time for these two interviews. We do appreciate it. So this concludes the interview with Heather Daniels.